The headlines: Yemenis hold a mass rally in Saudi to honor those killed in the Saudi-led war. The commander of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps says the force is now able to couple its defense operations with combat tactics. France is planning to take Britain to court on the issue of post-Brexit fishing licenses. Hello and welcome, everybody. Yemeni people holding a big rally to show their anger at the ongoing Saudi military aggression. Hours ago, the demonstrators converged in the city of Saada for the rally dubbed Loyalty to the Blood of Martyrs. They chanted slogans against Saudi Arabia and demanded justice for the victims of the seven-year war. The crowd of protesters also criticized the United States and Western countries for supporting the war. Saudi Arabia has recently stepped up its airstrikes, killing more Yemenis and causing more destruction. The war and economic blockade have taken a heavy toll on Yemen. Apart from hundreds of thousands of people who've lost their lives, millions are only a step away from hunger and lack access to basic health care. Our correspondent in Sana'a, Abdullatif al-Washali, says the message Yemeni protesters want to send the world is that the blood of those killed in Saudi attacks won't go to waste.
The Yemenis are protesting today in the Saada province to honor those who got killed by the Saudi-led coalition war on the country. They are proving to the whole world that they will remember the sacrifices of those who stood up and defended their country against the aggressors, against the Saudi-led coalition's forces in the country. They are telling the world, or sending a message to the world, that the blood of these people who got killed defending their land and their territories from the invaders will always be remembered by the Yemeni people, and they will absolutely keep fighting the aggressors. They will keep fighting the US-backed Saudi-led coalition until their last breath. Yemenis are defending their country. They have not been the aggressors against any other country. Saudis are killing the Yemeni people.
A senior Iranian military commander says a ground force of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps is displaying its latest accomplishments during the large-scale war games that are underway in the south of the country.
The drills featured massive artillery fire as well as operations by the Amphibious Operations Unit of the IRGC Ground Force. As you saw today, the exercises involved divers as well as large numbers of vessels taking combat troops to the shore, which was among the most important achievements of the IRGC Ground Force. This has enabled the force to couple its defense operations with combat tactics.
The IRGC forces wrapped up the ground phase by conducting extensive drills overnight. They rehearsed a combination of tactics using artillery and armored units, attack helicopters, and drones. The maneuvers have been ongoing in the Persian Gulf region, the Strait of Hormuz, as well as the coasts of Hormuzgan, Bushehr, and Khuzestan provinces. The exercises, codenamed the Great Prophet 17, are part of military drills Iran holds regularly to improve its combat power. The five-day maneuvers will end on Friday. This episode of Hashtag Trending will bring you social media's take on Iran's firm response to recent Israeli threats against its nuclear and military sites.
Hello everyone, and welcome to another Hashtag Trending with me, Ali Reza. Today we'll bring you social media's take on Iran's firm response to recent Israeli threats against its military and nuclear sites. Israel flexing its hyped-up military muscles against Iranian interests is nothing new, but the Islamic Republic never takes lightly to threats, especially when it comes from Tel Aviv, and that's why the Islamic Revolution Guard Corps has issued a warning that if such threats ever materialize, Iran will immediately and decisively attack all bases, centers, routes, and spaces used to carry out the aggression. Iranian officials have time and again advised Israel against making foolish mistakes, warning them of a crushing response that could bring about the annihilation of the occupying regime. Let's get on with our comments reel with this tweet by Tehran Times. They wrote, "Leader of Islamic Revolution Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said, sometimes leaders of Zionist regime threaten us. They are threatening to strike militarily, but I think they know it. And if they don't know, they must know if they make a mistake, Iran will destroy Tel Aviv and Haifa." All right, moving on to our next comment by Shobayed. He wrote, "Israel is stupid to even think about attacking Iran. Threatening Iran with words have such a response among our brothers and sisters in Pakistan. Seek your shelters. We are stronger than ever." Sufia has our next comment on Twitter. "Merg bar Israel, the protest near Masjid Shonda, Lahore. Its motive was to stop Israel from threatening Iran. If it keeps continuing to do it, then we resist against you as usual and will urge our government to take action against you because you are the enemy of the Muslim Ummah, not Iran." That's the kind of support that the Islamic Republic enjoys across the world. The concept that Israel is entirely unfamiliar with. Plus, let's suppose that Israel decided to move ahead with their foolish plan. It's simply beyond their current resources right now. They just don't have the means to pull it off right now. Anyways, moving on to our next comment by Wei Yan. They wrote, "The interesting thing is that the Sunni and Shia protesters were together chanting against Israel and America. It is a rally of the United Muslims Ummah." Moving on to our final batch of comments for the day, we have a comment by Qasem Ibn al-Hassan. He wrote, "Given that Iran has missile and drone capabilities and has deployed these weapons in the region, Israel's use of the atomic bomb will only lead to its own destruction and contamination of the region, Europe, and Africa." We have another tweet by Alex Kennedy. He wrote, "Iran says its ballistic missiles have a range of 2,000 kilometers and are capable of reaching U.S. bases in the region and Israel, which is planning to target Iranian nuclear sites if Iran starts enriching uranium to 90%. Amira D. Engelhart has our final tweet for the day. "Iranian defense forces launched 17 ballistic missile test attacks on the second day of the five-day Payambar-e Azam 17 drills in the southwest of Iran near the Persian Gulf." That's it for this edition of Hashtag Trending.
Moving on, the latest Palestinian victim of Israeli violence has been laid to rest in the city of Ramallah. New concerns are being raised over Israel's use of deadly force against Palestinians. We've discussed those concerns with our guests in our newsreel program. Let's take a listen. Palestinians hold a funeral for a young man who was killed by Israeli fire a day earlier. The mourning procession was held in the city of Ramallah in the occupied West Bank. The 26-year-old Mohammed Isa Abbas was shot in the back when Israeli forces opened fire on his car on Wednesday. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas is very critical of the new Israeli rules that give soldiers more freedom to use deadly force against Palestinians. It says the rules are further proof of the Israeli military leaders' criminal behaviors and terrorist policies that encourage the deliberate killing of innocent people. Israel has amended its open fire rules to allow soldiers to shoot at Palestinians who throw stones even when they don't pose an imminent threat. Joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have activist from the Scottish-Palestine Solidarity Campaign, Mr. McNapier, joining us from Edinburgh. Also, we have Mona Kandil, who's joining us from Ramallah. Let's start off with Mona in Ramallah. Tell us more about the funeral that was held for this young man who was killed by Israeli fire a day earlier, and also more details, if you can, about the incident itself.
Well, scores of Palestinians had taken part in the funeral processions of 26-year-old Palestinian Ahmed Abbas from the refugee camp of Al-Amari near Ramallah. The mourners chanted anti-Israel slogans, vowing to continue with the resistance and to avenge the killing of Mohammed Isa Abbas. What happened, according to the Israeli military statement, that Israeli soldiers had spotted a number of Palestinians approaching the illegal settlement of Bisigot in Al Biri, which is very close to the refugee camp of Al Am'ari. Then a passing vehicle opened fire at the Israeli soldiers. The Israeli soldiers inside their jeep chased up this vehicle until reaching the entrance to the Al Am'ari refugee camp, and they opened fire, seriously wounding the driver, who had transferred to a Palestinian hospital, and then he succumbed to his injuries there. He was identified as Mohammed Isa Abbas. It's not clear if this is the real story, or if the Israeli forces were carrying out arrest operation in the city of Ramallah and in the refugee camp of Al Am'ari, because they are used to raid the Palestinian villages, towns, and refugee camps. And of course, the clashes have taken place between Palestinian youths and Israeli soldiers last night.
Mick Napier, it's great to have you with us. Let's talk about the recent amendments that the Israeli regime has given its open fire rules, which now allows soldiers to shoot at Palestinians, even if they don't pose an imminent threat. What's the reasoning behind this? Please tell us more about the motives of the Israeli regime.
Look, the United Nations Human Rights Committee 2 years ago published a report, and they were very clear. They said Israel was killing journalists, quote, knowing that they are journalists, killing health workers, knowing that they are health workers, and they added, is killing children, knowing that they were children. And this report was the latest in a very long line of reports detailing how over many years the Israeli military have been deliberately and sometimes indiscriminately killing Palestinians. Now, the Americans have an intelligence agency, so do the British and all these, but they know what's going on, and it cannot be denied by any reasonable person that Israel is deliberately shooting and killing Palestinians. Sometimes they make a mistake, and I met the father of one young girl who was killed by Israeli soldiers, and the case was only interesting because the conversations between the soldiers were recorded and played on Israeli television. So what I'm saying is not in any doubt. There was a young woman, a young schoolgirl called Iman Al-Hams. The soldiers said, shoot her. One of the soldiers says, it's just a terrified schoolgirl. The officer said, kill her. Kill anything, even if it is 3 years old. Now, this is public. This is not deniable by anyone, even the Israelis. But the Israelis found that this soldier acted correctly in killing this child. Look, there are two British workers who've been murdered by the Israelis. One was Randall. He was shot dead by a sniper while he was protecting Palestinian schoolgirls from the sniper. Now, because that family had resources and access to serious lawyers, the Israelis denied it, said he was killed by a Palestinian, and then finally they admitted it. But Palestinians don't have access to any system of justice. Let me just add one final example. Chris Hedges is an American journalist, a prize-winning journalist, held in very high esteem. He reported from Gaza the number of Palestinian young boys, who were killed by Israeli snipers in one day. He added, he had been all over the world. He had seen people lined up and massacred. He'd seen women and children slaughtered so many times. He said Gaza, Rafah, was the only place he had seen children killed for sport by soldiers who were bored. This is not open to discussion. There is report after report, Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, the United Nations. Israel has long been killing Palestinians with complete impunity. There are more examples than one would have time to discuss. This tweaking of the rules is unnecessary. because Israeli soldiers have long reported themselves how they can kill Palestinians with impunity. It's very well known.
All right, thanks a lot. That's all the time we have for this segment of the program. Mona Candela, our correspondent, joining us from Ramallah. Also, special thanks to activist Mick Napier, speaking to us from Edinburgh. And that's a wrap for this edition of the News Review. Welcome back. We're following news out of Afghanistan, where a bomb attack has rocked the capital city. The blast took place close to the gate of the passport office in Kabul. Based on initial reports, it was a car bomb. The government says a suicide bomber has been killed and several people have been injured. No group has claimed responsibility yet. In recent weeks, there have been a series of bombings and terrorist attacks across Afghanistan. They were mostly claimed by the Daesh terrorist group, which is engaged in a fierce power rivalry with the Taliban. France will launch a lawsuit against Britain to settle a lingering dispute over post-Brexit fishing rights. The French Europe Minister says a high-profile meeting with EU representatives will take place in early January. And then, a suit will be filed with a special tribunal. Paris and London have been at loggerheads over how many licenses the French fishermen are entitled to. France accuses Britain of holding back on licenses. Last week, Britain agreed to issue an additional 23 licenses to French boats, but France believes it's entitled to around 80 more permits. Under a post-Brexit deal, EU fishermen can continue to work in British waters if they can prove they used to fish there. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Martyrdom is the best deal one can strike with God.
This is the part of the speech delivered on October 16, 2021 in a meeting with the officials in charge of the martyrs of Zanjan commemoration ceremony. The commemoration ceremony was held on October 28, 2021.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Praise be to God, Lord of the worlds. And peace and greetings be upon our Master Muhammad and upon his pure household, especially the remnant of God on earth. First of all, I wish to welcome all of you, dear brothers and sisters, especially the members of the families of the martyrs who are here today, the Honourable Mother of Three Martyrs, and all those involved in conducting this important commemoration ceremony. I truly thank all of you for starting and doing this valuable work. God willing, you will continue and complete it. Please send my sincere regards to the friends who have sent their greetings, including the youth and members of religious gatherings.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united. position and role of Zanjan in the history of Iran.
The city of Zanjan has achieved many accomplishments. Throughout history, Zanjan has earned many honors, both in scholarly areas and in action. These accomplishments have been achieved in the religious sciences, jurisprudence, philosophy and mysticism, and in social fields. There have been outstanding personalities with different orientations, but all of them have worked for and in the way of God. There have been personalities such as Akhund Mullah Qurban Ali and the like. Zanjan is truly an outstanding exemplary city. Regarding the new sciences, our well-known martyr in nuclear sciences, Martyr Shahriari, was one of the honorable sons of the city of Zanjan. Therefore, Zanjan has accomplished many feats. The martyrs from this area, too, are at the top of the list of achievements registered by Zanjan. I will mention a few points about the martyrs, and then I will discuss your work, the move to commemorate martyrs. As for martyrs, martyrs are chosen ones, chosen by God, the Exalted. Martyrs have chosen the right path, and God chose them to reach the destination. The value of martyrs cannot be measured with our material calculations. The martyrs have won in the best deal in the world. O you who have faith, shall I show you a deal that will deliver you from a painful punishment? Have faith in Allah and His Apostle and wage jihad in the way of Allah with your possessions and your persons. The Holy Quran, Surah 61, verses 10 to 11. And it continues to the end. The big winners in this deal are our martyrs. Indeed, Allah has bought from the faithful their souls and their possessions from paradise to be theirs. The Holy Quran, Surah 9, verse 111. What is better than this deal?
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You've guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
London Breed, mayor of San Francisco, has declared a state of emergency in the drug-infested neighborhood of Tenderloin to clean up what she called its nasty streets. The district has long been known for the number of homeless people, drug users, and drug dealers on the streets. Breed believes this state of emergency would disrupt the illegal activity in the neighborhood and get people the treatment and support they need. London Breed's announcement broke with the liberal tradition and exposed the extent of the crisis plaguing the city's streets. But San Francisco isn't the only city reeling from violence and drugs. More than 100,000 Americans died this year from drug overdoses. The situation has become so dire that U.S. President Joe Biden signed an executive order last week to fight organized crime networks whose actions are impacting the country's public health.
The overreach of the government dictates what families can do when it comes down to disciplining their children and all of that. So now you see generations having passed without any type of structure. The family is decaying. And of course, this is something that is touted on the news wave, media, all of those different things. It's a consistent thing where families are being denigrated.
In the meantime, cities across the U.S. are setting their all-time high records for homicides, most of which involving firearms. The Texas city of Austin, for example, where gun control is lax, has reported 88 homicides in 2021, eclipsing the previous high of 59 that was reported in 1984. Austin is among the 9 cities that have broken their homicide records. The case in point is that they are not concentrated, but are all scattered around the U.S. map. Stores across the U.S. have increasingly been coming under raids by mobs who have been collecting tens of thousands of dollars worth of cash and goods in recent weeks. Although most of the ransacked high-end stores are located in the U.S. state of California, similar incidents have been taking place elsewhere in the country too. Police statistics show that theft and larceny have been up about 88% compared to last year, with the overall crime rate standing at almost 52% higher in 2021. A recent study suggests that the crime rate in the underprivileged areas has jumped much higher compared to wealthier districts in the first 5 months of the coronavirus pandemic. Law enforcement officials reject the idea that the rise in the so-called smash-and-grab attacks has to do with the COVID-19 pandemic. Instead, they believe the police's permissive attitude toward theft and the holiday season have been the factors pushing the numbers.
And of course, this lawlessness is a result of things that are unjust, things that continue to happen, and righteous judgment is not being implemented or instituted. And so also to add to that, it's a departing of the morality, the values and everything that this country was supposed to have espoused 2 years ago that's been changed.
Some also believe law enforcement's lack of resources has forced the police to deprioritize theft, while others blame a lack of political will to fight such offenses. All indications are suggesting that the current crime rates in the U.S. are likely to become a new normal.
An investigation into the confidential files of the U.S. military has revealed a shocking truth about the American air war in West Asia. The New York Times says it has reviewed over 1,300 documents from a hidden Pentagon archive. The report has shed more light on how the U.S. undercounted thousands of civilian deaths caused by its deeply flawed intelligence and faulty targeting in Iraq, Syria, and Afghanistan. According to the military's count, over 1,600 civilians, many of them children, have died in U.S. air operations in Iraq, Syria, and Afghanistan. And even though the Times does not give a figure, it does say that the military has drastically undercounted the tally. The U.S. has a history of conducting similar strikes in Somalia, Libya, Yemen, and Pakistan out of the spotlight without accepting any responsibility while destroying the lives of civilians. New research from a London-based civilian harm monitoring group, Air Wars, showed that since 2001, at least 22,600 civilians were killed in U.S. strikes across various theaters, including Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Somalia, Libya, Yemen, and Pakistan. The group said that the number of civilian deaths could be potentially as high as 48,000. The documents show that the U.S. forces conducted more than 50,000 airstrikes in Iraq, Syria, and Afghanistan over a 5-year period. The majority of strikes were carried out without prior plans. The report also brings into question the Pentagon's claims of transparency and accountability. Based on the report, only a few assessments of faulty raids have been made public, and surprisingly, none have found any wrongdoing or led to disciplinary action. The U.S. military, from the terrorist CENTCOM to the Department of Defense, does not provide official estimates of civilian deaths, nor have they published such findings. They simply kill civilians and rarely offer compensation.
The lack of accountability, even in the way in which these crimes are being revealed, shows that this is accepted within the political establishment of the U.S. government today. And it has been, when you look at past wars and the incredible number of civilian casualties.
In its report, the New York Times reviewed cases in which civilians were killed, none of which resulted in an admission of wrongdoing. The report says poor or inadequate surveillance footage often contributed to deadly targeting failures. Most recently, 10 people were killed in a U.S. drone strike in the Afghan capital, Kabul. Washington initially claimed to have targeted terrorists, but later it was revealed that all the victims were civilians, including 7 children. Washington was forced to admit that the attack had been a tragic mistake, taking civilian lives. But eventually, it decided that no one would be punished for the erroneous strike. Also, the New York Times says it has visited nearly 100 casualty sites in Iraq, Syria, and Afghanistan and interviewed scores of survivors to compile the report. Even though many civilian survivors now have to live with disabilities that require expensive treatment, only fewer than a dozen have received compensation.
Well, just to say, it's also important to recognize that the only people who've ever been prosecuted for the drone strikes are those who revealed that drone strikes were going on and that they were targeting civilians. I'm speaking about Daniel Hale, now in prison for exposing U.S. civilian strikes, Julian Assange. There's a refusal to hold anyone accountable.
The U.S. has kept killing civilians with impunity and without accountability in various theaters. It also suppresses the leaked information about crimes it committed in those countries. For instance, its efforts to punish the WikiLeaks founder, Julian Assange, who caused Washington great embarrassment by disclosing confidential military and diplomatic records in 2010. These documents included classified military and diplomatic information, detailing U.S. bombing campaigns in Afghanistan and Iraq, information about civilian deaths, and secret U.S. drone strikes in Yemen in face of American officials' denial. His case proves that Washington fears its misdeeds being revealed again. Scores of Palestinians have been injured by Israeli settlers in villages around the city of Nablus in the occupied West Bank following a shooting near an illegal outpost in Homesh that left one settler dead and 2 wounded. Dozens of Israeli settlers attacked Qaryut village south of Nablus overnight. The attackers broke into many homes in the town and assaulted local families. Scores of Palestinians were injured in the process and moved to several hospitals in Nablus. According to the Palestinian media, the settlers also blocked the main highway connecting Nablus and Ramallah and attacked vehicles with Palestinian license plates with stones, causing damages to several cars. In reaction to the attacks, the Palestinian Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Expatriates called on the United Nations to promptly activate the international protection system for Palestinian civilians under Israeli occupation. It also called on the international community to pressure the Israeli regime into stopping acts of terrorism committed by settlers against Palestinians and their communities. The ministry held the regime of Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett fully and directly responsible for settler violence and terror, and warned against the dangerous repercussions of their acts on the status of the region. It is stressed that Israeli authorities are encouraging and protecting settler violence, which is soaring on a daily basis. According to Israeli advocacy group B'Tselem, 2021 saw a rise in settler violence of 28.6% compared to last year. UN human rights experts have expressed alarm at the rising rate of violence directed by Israeli settlers toward Palestinians in the occupied Palestinian territory. According to the United Nations Office for the Coordination of the Humanitarian Affairs, already in the first 10 months of 2021, there have been 410 attacks by settlers against Palestinians. 4 Palestinians were killed by settlers this year. Nearly 700,000 Israelis live in over 230 settlements built since the 1967 occupation of the Palestinian territories of the West Bank. All the settlements are illegal under international law, and the United Nations Security Council has condemned the settlement activities in several resolutions. Since occupying the West Bank, Israel has misappropriated more than 200,000 hectares of land there for its own purposes, including building and expanding settlements and paving roads for settlers. Some areas have been taken over by the regime, issuing military orders, others through daily acts of settler violence. These two seemingly unrelated tracks are both forms of state violence. The Israeli apartheid regime and its representatives actively aid and abet the settlers' violence as part of his strategy to cement the takeover of Palestinian land.
The settlers and the uniformed soldiers work together, not without tensions, but they always support each other, and the settlers are used to carry out the particular kinds of attacks, burning trees, certain kinds of terror attacks, which the army prefers not to do. They shoot, they kill, but they protect the settlers 100% of the time. The settlers know this, and it gives them a sense of complete impunity.
Last week, the U.S. Under Secretary of State Victoria Nuland and an Israeli minister who is responsible for police discussed the increase in settler violence against Palestinians. That drew rebukes from pro-settlement ministers and right-wing opposition lawmakers within the Israeli regime. Omer Bar-Lev later pushed back his critics, saying they were having difficulty looking in the mirror and that settler violence has become an issue on the international stage. But Israel's Prime Minister, Naftali Bennett, jumped in to say it's just a marginal issue. In a tweet on Tuesday, he noted that there are marginal elements in every community, and they should be dealt with using all means, but we must not generalize about an entire community. The Combatants for Peace group, which brings together Israeli and Palestinian victims of violence, condemned Bennett for his Tuesday comments, charging that the Prime Minister had given full backing to depraved settler violence, which has reached new heights under his watch. The group added that Bennett gave a green light to the Wild West atmosphere in the territories. Also, an interview published on Wednesday revealed what Israeli Foreign Minister thinks about this issue. He told an American periodical earlier this month that extremist violence is a stain on Israel amid a noted rise in violent attacks by Israeli settlers against Palestinians.
There is a situation in the West Bank which is lawless. You might consider the situation to be one of no legal protection for Palestinians whatsoever.
Bennett's marginalization of the issue was aimed at legitimizing and praising settler violence, which is soaring on a daily basis. Let's not forget that Israeli soldiers and police usually defend the attackers or simply stand to the side when they assault Palestinians. Therefore, settler violence is a central issue that requires urgent attention from the international community to put an end to it.
Morgan, Helen Margaret Lillian, Liberal Democrats, 17,957.
In another setback for the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, his Conservative Party has lost its North Shropshire seat to Liberal Democrats in a by-election, the constituency the Tories dominated for nearly 200 years. In her victory speech, Helen Morgan said the results reflect the British people's views about the Conservative Party.
Tonight, the people of North Shropshire have spoken on behalf of the British people. They've said loudly and clearly, Boris Johnson, the party is over.
The Liberal Democrats, in my view, have never been an alternative to the Conservative Party. They're really there's very little difference between the policies of the Liberal Democrats and Conservatives. In other words, when the Conservatives lose credibility, they bring out the Liberal Democrats, who are sort of centrist, never represented any concrete or coherent alternative to the Conservative Party.
Conservative lawmaker Roger Gale also says the by-election can be regarded as a referendum on the Prime Minister's performance. The by-election was called after the former MP for North Shropshire stepped down for breaching the Parliament's paid lobbying rules. The British government tried to avert the resignation by changing the rules, but later faced a backlash and was forced to backtrack. That was only one in the long list of issues raising questions about Boris Johnson's leadership. Opposition politicians accused Johnson of being a serial liar and incompetent leader, with some demanding that he resign.
Clearly, the vote in North Shropshire.
Boris Johnson acknowledged that the shocking results of the North Shropshire by-election contained a message for him and his party.
I'm responsible for everything that the government does, and of course I take personal responsibility.
But there's too much responsibility to shoulder, as Boris Johnson's tenure has been replete with a spate of allegations and scandals. The Premier stands accused of breaking the law by using Conservative Party donations to renovate his residence at No. 11 Downing Street. He's also under pressure for reported parties in his office last Christmas, disregarding the very COVID-19 restrictions the government had imposed. British dailies The Guardian and The Independent have also reported that Boris Johnson himself joined a pizza party in Downing Street in May last year amid the first nationwide lockdown. Obviously, the Premier is also under fire for his handling of the pandemic. On Tuesday, he suffered a humiliating rebellion from Conservative lawmakers over measures to curb the spread of the Omicron variant of the coronavirus. In addition, damaging disclosures have surfaced about some of the Conservative MPs who've moonlighted as political consultants or advisors, raking in tens of thousands of pounds by lobbying. The metaphorical pendulum in Britain's domestic politics appears to be swinging to the other side. The Conservatives have a couple of years to stop that from happening.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Almighty God also says that all the followers of the Bible come to us and let us talk about the issues that are common amongst us, and we are agree on these points. So Sayyid Mujtaba Mousavi Lahri starts from this point.
This kind of decision that he makes puts him in a way that he start writing some papers in a collection, and we may consider that book or the publication of that book as a kind of hope-giving.
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in The Teacher.
What will we say in front of it?
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is The Teacher, a program on the life and works of the prominent Muslim Shia scholars, figures, and jurists all across the world of Islam. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Mahtabi and Sheikh Ziyaniya. Sheikh Mahtabi, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And Sheikh Ziyaniya, assalamu alaikum.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
Today we want to continue our discussion regarding the life and works of Sayyid Mujtaba Mousavi Lahri, one of the most outstanding contemporary figures whose works have been translated into more than 20 languages all across the world. He was famous for his methodology, or better say method of preaching Islam in non-Muslim lands, and that's why his books attracted so many people. He was also very much concerned with the socio-cultural and political affairs of his society in Iran and also the world of Islam. That's why the main frameworks of his works are regarding Islam as a framework for life, is better to say. Regarding the works of Sayyid Mujtaba Mousavi Lahri, they are really on different topics, but what is important is that his method of compiling these books must be the same, or it is the same. Sheikh Mahtabi, let's start with you, brother. Can you give us some details, or is better to say, enumerate some of the attributes of the method of Ayatollah Sayyid Mujtaba Mousavi Lahri in compiling his books regarding Islam?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. A very good question. When we want to know about his works,
this is very beneficial to point out some factors, so which we can benefit from these factors if also we want to conduct works like his works to be famous and well-known worldwide. One of the factors that we mentioned in the previous session is that he had this look to put aside the differences and give our main focus on similarities and commonalities, no matter if we are approaching non-Muslim community or if we are approaching different denomination within Islamic community. So this is very important factors that we can highlight throughout his works. Another factor is the fair look. This is also a very good point.
That's right.
When it reaches to Western culture, I want to point out this one. Why? Because one of his famous work that is well known by the elite worldwide is The Western Civilization Through Muslim Eyes.
That's right.
And this book mainly talks about the Western civilization and kind of criticism upon Western civilization. But when we see, the book is fascinating to the point that Westerners, those who have no relationship with Islam, they are not Muslim, they are really interested in the book, that they seek permission from the author of the book that are we allowed to translate it into our mother language. Actually, this is recorded in the history that Professor Golden, he himself contacted late Sayyid Mujtaba Musavi Lari and asked for permission, and he permitted him. And after that, one of his friend, I mean the friend of Professor Golden in Germany, since he was also fascinated by the book, he said, also, I really like to translate it into German language.
That's right.
And also, Professor Khaled Kiba from Japan, he asked for permission. We see sometimes those who are involved in the publication of books, they know how difficult is the translation of the book and distribution of the book. It's really hard work to write your book in a way that your audience, they themselves ask for translation of your book.
That's right.
So because of his fair look in this book, and he also mentions this point in the introduction of fourth edition of this book,
yes,
saying that I had a very fair look upon the Western civilization. I mentioned in my book that we are not going to deny and reject the blessing,
yes,
and happiness and welfare that Western civilization brought for the world.
Yes.
This is something good. We actually acknowledge this, but
yes,
we have to take into consideration that the mistake being done by Western civilization is to give focus on the material life.
Right.
So the only thing they are going to limit the life of a human being is to confine his life into the material life. So after this material life, there is no end, no goal.
That's right.
So the life is going to be pointless.
That's all right. This is really fascinating. As you said, in the Persian language, the title is Islam va simay tamaddun gharb, but the English title would be Western Civilization Through Muslim Eyes. They can find, the English translation of this book available and all the other works of Sayyid Mujtaba Musavi Lari on alislam.org. All of them are free to download. That's a really fascinating website for those who are interested in Shiite theology and history, and they can download for free the books and also the audios and the videos in English language regarding Shiite Islam. Okay, thank you much, Sheikh Mahtavi. Sheikh Ziyani, let's get to you, brother. Again, we get back to the main method of Sayyid Mujtaba Musavi Lari in compiling this book and the other books, because I think his method also can be seen, and traces of his method of research can be seen in his other works too. Explain a little bit more for us about this method.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Late Sayyid Mujtaba Musavi Lari was believing in that the problem of today's humanity is modern blasphemy and modern idol worshipping. Mm-hmm. That's why he tries to put the most emphasis in his works on Tawheed and the unity of God.
Yes.
So he tries to make people sensitive regarding this sense of worshipping that is in the essence of human being, in his nature and in his fitrat, that he wants to worship someone. So he believes that in modern age, human being is involved in blasphemous worships, and he is worshipping while he is thinking that I'm not worshipping anyone.
So you mean the modernity has made the humanity very much busy with the modern idols? These are not necessarily the idols of the past generation, but these are the new generation of the idols around.
Exactly.
Whatever makes the human busy.
Exactly. Okay. So he says that these, you know, materialistic aspects of life,
yes,
or job, or, you know, different, yes, issues in modern life come to the point that they are like idols in his life. And we see some people that they are worshipping their job. Mm-hmm. They are worshipping their salary. They are worshipping their social position. So he says that, okay, if we want to get human being, you know, freed from modern problems, we need to help him to get freed from this worshipping, and he is in need of a return to the worshipping of God, the exalted. That if human being returns to this point,
yes,
then he may, you know, restart his life in a way that many problems that had been occurred in his life, in his modern life, would be solved in future.
I think when we take a look at this book and the other books that have been compiled by Sayyid Mojtaba Mousavi Lahori, we can understand that he is not talking directly to the Muslims only. He is talking to the humanity, al-insan, or the human beings in general. And that's why I make his books, I mean, very much interesting for the readers to read out. And then, at the end, he says, there are different theologies or schools of thought, and this is what Islam says. Yeah. And this Islam, I think the definition of Islam by Sayyid Mojtaba Mousavi Lahori is very much interesting. Islam, which is peaceful, which believes in a peaceful coexistence, which believes in the beauty of the life, and which believes in the rahmah of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. This is really beautiful. I mean, this Islam, I think the pure Muhammadan Islam that we are talking about, okay, on which we are talking about, this is the Islam that was meant by Sayyid Mojtaba Mousavi Lahori and interested so many people, and so many people converted to the religion of Islam because of his books.
You know, this is exactly in accordance with this riwayat from Imam Ridha alayhi salam, that لَوْ عَلَمَ النَّاسْ مَا حَوْسِبْنَا كَلَامِنَا لَتَّبَعُونَا. If the people were knowing the beauties of our words, then they would follow us. Mm-hmm. So Sayyid Mojtaba Mousavi Lahori rahmatullah alayhi is trying to give the beauties of Islam without giving this sense of superiority to his audience.
That's
that,
right,
I want to give a higher type of information to you. No. He says that there are different schools of thought. Now this one is a new one. You may think about it.
Yes.
And if you find it's, you know, beautiful and nice, you may try to follow it.
That's all right. Okay, Sheikh Mahtavi, any other details can you give us about this Islam that he has pictured for us? I mean, in our minds, Sayyid Mojtaba Mousavi Lahori.
Definitely. What I'm going to add to what my brother said, that the way he was presenting Islam was so much interesting that we see that there were a kind of communication between him and a cardinal in the Vatican, that one of the friend of late Sayyid Mojtaba Mousavi Lahori, Dr. Philip Woolley, he quotes that one of the cardinals of Vatican has requested to have some copies of your book. Mm-hmm. And besides this, we have the Crown Prince of Great Britain, mm-hmm, Charles Wells.
Okay.
Also, he received some copies of his works and some copies of his books, and he really acknowledged and appreciated and asked his secretary to respond, mm-hmm,
Sayyid Mujtaba, yes, late Sayyid Mujtaba Mousavi al-Lari.
That's right.
So these communication with these figures, which was not only limited to the category of elite of the society, it goes up to the level that politicians would make such communication with him, shows that he was truly preaching Islam in its real sense.
That's
not
right.
To put any kind of superiority.
That's right.
Color upon yes. that, which is not going to tolerate it by okay. other people easily, specifically yes. those who have no faith yes. in Islam. So he was really the true preacher of Islam. May Allah bless him.
That's right. I think this broad-mindedness is also very important, because we have so many Muslim scholars. They are really full-scale, you know, scholars and ulama. But what is important is that some of their sayings or prescriptions or guidelines are very much limited to the very limited society they are living in. And I think this was not true about Sayyid Mujtaba Mousavi al-Lari, because he considered Islam as a role model for the people all across the world without forcing them to convert to the religion of Islam. Okay, this is very important, because by introducing Islam, we don't want necessarily the people to convert to the religion of Islam, but we want to be more familiar with the Islam, with its framework, with its guidelines, who are the best role models in that, and what Islam truly says. Today's and in today's world, with the power of the media, the people like Sayyid Mujtaba Mousavi al-Lari and his framework of thought are really needed. Why? Because the media is showing a kind of violent, harsh, ISIS-like picture out of the religion of Islam to the Western world. And the beauties of Islam and the blessings of Islam are neglected. Sayyid Mujtaba Mousavi al-Lari can be a nice example in order to tell the Western world that that is not Islam. What is shown to us is not Islam. The real Islam is this.
Even I want to mention this point, that his audiences are not limited only to elite people or politicians, or his audiences are not only living in Western societies, but also, for example, his book were transferred into the prisons in Africa. And some prisoners studied this book, and when the government of that country faced with, you know, the big difference among prisoners, they asked the institution of Sayyid Lari in Qom to send them some more copies from this book, because they said that when the prisoners, they studied this book, they have you know, notable changes in this in behavior. Their behavior.
That's right, very good.
So, you know, his message is not only limited to Western culture, but also includes the people who are poor in their mind, and they feel that they have some kind of lack of, you know, God and the exalted power in their life.
That's all right. Okay, as I said in our previous discussion, God and His attributes, again translated by Hamed Elgar, Imamat and leadership, and knowing God, translated by F.J. Golding, are among the most outstanding works of Sayyid Mujtaba Mousavi al-Lari. Thank you much, Sheikh Ziyaniya and Sheikh Mahdawi, for your presence in the program, The Teacher, talking about Sayyid Mujtaba Mousavi al-Lari. May Allah bless his soul. And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/Ian Call of Islam page, also our YouTube channel and Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
The United States is appealing a British judge's decision not to extradite Julian Assange, the Australian journalist and founder of WikiLeaks. In January, Judge Baretzer found that US prison conditions would be too oppressive and that Assange would be likely to take his own life. In response, the United States has taken to the High Court to contest her findings about Assange's health. In addition, the United States has offered up diplomatic assurances, saying that it won't put Assange in oppressive prison conditions, which doctors have said would lead to suicide. So what exactly are these diplomatic assurances that the United States has offered? And can they actually be trusted? How come Assange's health is the center of the discussion when scores of legal experts, academics, journalists, and historians have all warned that this indictment currently poses the biggest threat to press freedoms?